KALW.
First thing I thought is, that's crazy. Why would we make it more convenient for someone to shoot up?
Mayor London Breed has been fighting for safe injection sites since she was first elected.
All the things that people said we couldn't do because of the law, we did them here in San Francisco.
We'll hear what's next in the legal battle. Then author Carolina De Robertis explores what it means to be LGBTQ in her family's country.
We have a saying in South America, el que no sabe de dónde viene, no sabe de a dónde va. He or she who doesn't know where they come from doesn't know where they're going.
And for this week's Audiograph, we're going somewhere wild right here in the city. I'm Hannah Baba, and this is Cross Currents. San Francisco Mayor London Breed has been an advocate for safe injection sites for illegal drug users since she was first elected in June of 2018. It's an idea that's, well, pretty unpopular with the federal government. But earlier this fall, a federal judge ruled that a safe injection site in Philadelphia does not violate federal law. Now, a newly reelected Mayor Breed wants to find out what that ruling could mean for San Francisco. In this award-winning story from our archives, reporter Claire Strempel explores the idea.
More than 22,000 people inject drugs in San Francisco. Helder Peralta is one of them.
Yeah, in general, like before all the drugs and all the bad stuff kicked in, pretty positive, happy, outgoing person. I actually enjoyed my life.
It's been a decade since Peralta started using drugs. When he became homeless 2 years ago, he started injecting heroin.
I've been the person in the tent, starving, not eaten in 3 days.
The city wants to get people like Peralta into housing and rehab programs before it's too late. A key part of this effort is safe injection sites. They're clean, medically supervised places for drug users to shoot up. At first glance, it's counterintuitive. To make the city healthier, the plan is to provide a space for drug users to inject potentially lethal drugs. The promise is these facilities would take drug use off the streets and get users somewhere safe and clean. It sounds like a great plan to Peralta. We met at HealthRight 360, his clinic on Mission Street.
I know plenty of people that would, I've literally mentioned it 2 or 3 times, and their eyes got wide open like, yeah.
Supervised injection sites are a step beyond the harm reduction services that San Francisco already has, like clean needle exchanges and the wide availability of the overdose-reversing drug, Narcan. The goal is to save lives and reduce disease. But Peralta sees another benefit. Restoring his dignity.
Not being humiliated in the street, not having to hide, not having to put a sweater over your head and with a flashlight in your mouth and trying to, yeah, it would help.
Supervised injection sites are a brand new concept to Americans. They haven't been done before because they're currently illegal. So most people don't know what they are. That's why activists are trying to introduce the concept at community events like the Sunday Streets Festival and the Sunset.
It's like a nice metal sterile booth where people were able to wipe it down and keep it nice and clean.
Charles Hawthorne works for the Harm Reduction Coalition. He shows me a booth that looks like a station at a hair salon, except instead of scissors and shampoo, there's needles and Narcan. It's an outlier at a street fair where families are cruising by on bikes.
There usually is some injection equipment, so it would be things like needles, ties, cookers, whatever it is they need to prepare their drug. And it's just kind of a personal space, so you can spread your stuff out, you can relax, you don't have to be sitting here rushing in the ground trying to hide it.
He makes it sound comfortable, which isn't something you usually associate with hard drugs. But making it comfortable is key to getting people to come to these places, instead of shooting up in alleys. Trained staff would watch out for overdoses, teach safe injection techniques, and more importantly, connect users to treatment programs.
Mostly it also functions as a way to just kind of bring people into the healthcare system in general. They might feel isolated. They might feel left out of the system in a lot of different ways.
The Department of Public Health says about 100 people per year die from opioid overdoses in San Francisco. New research shows supervised injection sites can keep addicts out of the hospital without increasing drug use. In Vancouver, one of the cities where sites are legal, the number of injection drug users hasn't grown in the decade safe injection sites have been operating. Dr. Alex Kral conducted that study. He's with the Research Triangle Institute, a nonprofit research group.
I think the most compelling results are just that it reduces the likelihood of dying from overdose. It reduces HIV infections, hepatitis C infections, saves city money.
A lot of money. One safe injection site could save San Francisco more than $3 million a year. That's according to the study Kral published in the Drug Policy Journal. He says a designated place to inject would help solve another problem, needles on the street.
I think people are just fed up. They're like, fix it. Just fix it. If it's going to get the needles off the streets, if it's going to get folks off the street, if it's going to possibly be an opening to help someone who struggles with addiction, then let's try it.
That's London Breed. She says safe injection sites didn't make sense to her at first.
First thing I thought is, that's crazy. Why would we do something like that? Why would we make it more convenient for someone to shoot up?
Policymakers see the misery of drug use right there in the streets around Civic Center on their way to work at City Hall. It's a daily reminder of where their efforts fall short. So San Francisco politicians are ready to take risks. For example, supervised injection sites break almost every conceivable drug law, short of selling the stuff. They violate the federal crack house statute, which bans providing a place to use drugs. Breed wants the city to move ahead anyway.
I mean, it's San Francisco. You know, we operate, I think, differently from any place else in the world.
San Francisco has a track record of breaking the law first and changing the law later. Same-sex marriage, sanctuary cities, and marijuana.
You know, ultimately, I think we just need to do it and let the chips fall where they may.
Meanwhile, people who work with drug users joke that the city effectively already has injection sites. BART stations downtown and here at the main branch of the San Francisco Public Library. We're not in the stacks, obviously. We're in the downstairs bathroom. Library guards like Nick Loya kick users out of the bathroom every day. They're not just policing drug use. They're also saving lives.
This is the intranasal Narcan.
Since a fatal overdose inside the library a couple years ago, the library decided to stock Narcan, an opioid blocker. It's kept in the security office, in the first aid kit, next to the Band-Aids. There's a metaphor here. Like a Band-Aid, Narcan is a short-term fix. It saves a life, but it doesn't cure addiction. It's not a substitute for treatment.
So it goes in the nostril, just all one shot. Just hold it like you would like a nasal spray. There's no real set time as to how long it takes for it to work. On average, I say probably between 2 and 4 minutes. Just depends on how long that person's been down for.
Loya has only been working at the library for 6 months, but he says he's had to administer Narcan 3 times already. Over 100 library staff volunteered to learn to use nasal Narcan. Librarians are effectively serving on the front lines of this public health crisis. And drug users keep coming to the library because it's safer than the street.
You're not going to get beat up in there. No one's going to break into a stall and steal your drugs or beat you up for whatever reason. There's security in there. And we would get kicked out on a regular basis.
Libraries are for books, not heroin. But I was curious, if Peralta had a safe place to go inject, would he be less committed to quitting drugs?
I know what you're asking, and some people could say and will say that safe injection sites are just going to cause people to automatically want to use more drugs. People don't wake up in the morning and say, I want to be a drug addict. People wake up in the morning saying, I wonder how long I'm going to live today. And if there's someone out there that's going to make it safe for you to live, hey, you know, let it be.
Local governments can start new programs to fight existing health threats without approval from the state. So London Breed could make a city-run safe injection site happen. But it's a bold move without the umbrella of protection from state law. Even so, a sanction from the mayor could allow these sites, and maybe more people like Peralta, to move forward. In San Francisco, I'm Claire Strempel for Cross Currents.
Claire originally reported that story last year. It won an award for investigative reporting from the San Francisco Press Club. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. In 2001, Carolina de Robertis traveled to her family's country, Uruguay. She wanted to know about the nation's queer history. What she learned on the trip inspired her latest book, Cantoras. The story is about five lesbians from Uruguay living in a dictatorship in the 1970s and 80s. They must hide their sexuality for their own safety, but during the ups and downs of their lives and love, the women escape to a rustic beach that becomes their sanctuary. KALW's Janae Darden sat down with Carolina de Robertis.
What is it about historical fiction that appeals to you?
You know, I think I'm just really drawn to deepening my own understanding of my roots and, in general, on a societal level, our deepening understanding of our roots and how that shapes who we are. So we have a saying in South America, el que no sabe de dónde viene, no sabe de a dónde va. He or she who doesn't know where they come from doesn't know where they're going. And I think that's part of my interest in it, is it's not just about writing history, but about writing our way towards a deeper understanding of where we are and who we want to become.
And I imagine, too, sometimes when you're writing history, you see so much similarities in the present.
Yes, absolutely. And I think those of us who write fiction that is set in other times are often operating with a double consciousness, where we're writing with a particularity of that time. So in the case of this novel, Cantoras, it's set beginning in the 1970s and mostly in the 70s and 80s in Uruguay and under a military dictatorship most of the time and then after. But I'm writing it today. I'm writing it here. I'm writing it in the Trump era, in fact. Right. You know, I mean, I gathered the material for it for 18 years, but did the actual writing in this era. And there is that double consciousness of also at least swimming through the deeper themes in a manner that is resonant to me in the time we're living through and hopefully will be resonant to readers on that level, too.
Cantores. I just love what the title means, and I'm sure you can explain it more beautifully than I can.
Please explain. Thank you for saying that. You know, it's interesting because this is a title that came to the book at the end when I'd already finished writing
it.
It had many other working titles, and yet it feels so central to the book now. So cantores is a word that means singers, and of course it means female singers, which, you know, the English language can't do that, right? When we say singers, it could be any gender. Cantoras means female singers, and it's an old-fashioned word for singers that this group of women who I met when I went to Uruguay in 2001, seeking my own relationship with the country as a, you know, member of the diaspora, a young queer woman, and had been really rocky coming out to my parents, and I wanted my own relationship to my country of origin and to find traces of the invisible histories of queer people in my country of origin. I was like, they have to be somewhere, right? You know, and I found these women who came of age, you know, a generation before me during the dictatorship, and I learned from them that they had used the word cantoras as code for lesbian, you know, in this time where they had to be incredibly under the radar to stay safe and alive. Right. They would say, you know, do you think she's a cantora? You know, does she sing? You know, wink, wink. You know, and so it has all of this innuendo built into it. And to me, that word, you know, it has, of course, this suggestive layer, but it also has a layer about what does it mean to be a woman who actually claims your voice, who sings, who fills the air with sound on your own terms.
So you traveled to Uruguay and you found women who lived through this dictatorship and they had to hide. What were they like?
I mean, you know, really incredible and really down-to-earth people. So the first person I met was Gabi, and I went to Uruguay on this trip. I was in my mid-20s, and I was, you know, feeling really vulnerable because my parents were in the process of cutting off ties with me.
I'm sorry.
And, yeah, you know, and that's been a permanent thing. Mm-hmm. In the process, one of the things they said to me was, you are no longer Uruguayan because you're gay. And this is something that doesn't exist in our country of origin, which can sound pretty absurd, but is something that's actually very common in immigrant communities. And I've had this conversation with immigrants from lots of different cultures mm-hmm. where, you know, sometimes the parents look at their own country through, like, nostalgia, or they remember the country from 30 years ago, the one that they left, where maybe those voices actually were completely invisible. And I wanted to not have to choose between my queerness and my Latinidad and my connection to Uruguay. So I go to Uruguay, and I have in my suitcase this piece of paper with the phone number of a woman who is the aunt of someone I met here in the Bay Area, Natalia Bernal. And she says, you know, well, I have this aunt. She's a lesbian. Oh, really? She's a lesbian. Here's your phone number. So I call this woman with shaking hands, mm-hmm. and she tells me that she'd love to meet up, but she's leaving for the beach tomorrow. And I say, oh, too bad, you know. And then she says, well, would you like to come? And looking back, I'm just amazed at her trust and openness. So this gets at your question of what were they like? So generous and open. I didn't tell her, my niece told me you're gay. I didn't say I'm gay. Mm-hmm. I didn't say any of that. I just said, I met your niece and I'm here in Montevideo. And next thing I know, the following night, you know, we are driving up the coast and we're going to this rustic beach with no running water mm-hmm. and no electricity. And I am just stunned by their generosity, how they took me in this way. And then I met their friends over the course of these days.
And were these all queer women?
Yes, they were all queer women. They were all queer women. So this little far-flung beach, Cabo Polonio, which is near the border of Brazil, has become a real haven for bohemian types, hippie types, and for queer people. You know, so I had this experience of spending time with them. And at first they were very reserved, but when they found out that they could come out to me, the stories just started flowing, you know, deep into the night under the starlight. And it was life-changing for me.
So this seaside town, this beach is a real place.
The beach is a real place.
Do you see love and being your true self as an act of resistance? And I know that's been talked about a lot lately, especially right now what's going on in the climate, especially here in the United States. But is it too much pressure to even put that on yourself? Can I just be me? Does it have to be politicized?
I think that's a fantastic question for us all to be asking ourselves. I mean, I think it depends on your position in society. Mm-hmm. For some people, just being themselves is not an act of resistance. It doesn't necessarily go against the grain of who this society is designed for. But for many of us, it already is an act of resistance. And that doesn't mean that we have to be consciously political with every moment. But I do think that loving authentically is revolutionary for many of us. And affirming the right of all people to love deeply and authentically is revolutionary for many of us. I mean, I'm very conscious that my wife and I could not have legally married on two levels in this country a generation ago, as an interracial couple and as a, you know, queer couple, as a same-sex couple. And when we first got married in 2002, it was an act of civil disobedience. It wasn't legal anywhere in the country. And that's part of why this book, not too many spoilers, but it ends in 2013 with the legalization of gay marriage in Uruguay. So these women watch that sweep of change. And I think about it raising my kids. I mean, just loving and affirming my kids with everything they are as beautiful multiracial kids with two moms matters. It does ripple out to social impact. I think whether or not we frame it that way every day, living bravely on the margins is not separate from social change. This is a story that begins in the bleakest of times, right? During this brutal and terrifying dictatorship in Uruguay, but it takes us through to another time of possibility and renewal.
That was author Carolina de Robertis speaking with KALW's Janae Darden. You can meet the author on Wednesday, November 13th at the San Francisco Public Library's main branch. Find more information at KALW.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Next up is Audiograph, the Bay Area's sonic signature. And today, we're going to a forest. Let's find out who's making that noise in this story from our archives with reporter Hannah Kingsley Ma.
Here's a personal first. I'm staring directly into the face of a one-eyed lemur, willing it to speak.
Thanks for stopping by and visiting the lemurs of Lemur Forest. And be sure to stop by our other exhibits.
All I can hear is a lawnmower somewhere off in the distance, the cries of seagulls and the rustling of nearby squirrels. So, not exactly worth the price of admission. It's like this lemur knows I'm waiting for it to make a sound and is taunting me with its silence. But then, the clock strikes 10. The San Francisco Zoo opens its gates to the public, and lemurs are released into the enclosure. More lemurs start loping out. Some black and white ruffed lemurs, some ringtail lemurs. Seven different types live in this exhibit. They start talking to one another. Lemurs are primates, small ones roughly the size of a raccoon. They're nimble, scrambling up a tree with the use of their hands and feet, big bushy tail waving in the air. They have these funny wide eyes that make them look like they're always surprised.
And people are very surprised that an animal that size creates such a loud sound.
That's David Boyshin. He's vice president of animal care at the San Francisco Zoo.
They chorus. When one animal vocalizes, the rest of the group joins in. The rough lemurs live in a dense rainforest, and animals that live in a forest like that, where it's hard to see, often communicate with sound.
Boyshin has a soft spot for these guys.
I think they're very forgiving. I think they're very unusual. They're gentle. I mean, they can be very tough on each other. And that's natural history. That's how animals are. But in general, you know, we go in with these animals. They're not dangerous. They're very accommodating of us. And they follow our rules. They play by the rules. And we give them lots of freedom because of that.
At a zoo, we're used to seeing animals in cages, separated by thick glass or a chain link fence. The Lemur Forest exhibit is open. The lemurs have the lay of the land. From an elevated wooden deck, you can watch them clamber up high and hang out on wide nets, all on top of each other in one big lemur cuddle puddle.
If I were a zoo lemur, this is where I'd want to be.
One of the lemurs takes a wild leap from a branch. The crowd, an assorted group of preschoolers on a field trip, goes wild.
Look at that! That's like it's like it's like
look at that!
It's like
fun of those ringtailed lemurs. They actually do that.
No, it's just funny.
Yeah.
The lemurs, they have a lot of character. People like them. And Boyshin thinks that charm serves a greater purpose.
You know, there's a powerful story to tell here.
These lemurs were bred in captivity, but in the wild, they're only found in Madagascar. The island is home to an amazing array of animal and plant species, but it's also experienced rampant deforestation over the last century, endangering a lot of the wildlife that it hosts. There are more than 100 lemur species, and over a fifth of them are critically endangered.
If anyone comes to see this exhibit, they should use it as a springboard to learn more about Madagascar and about conservation in general.
They are considered to have evolved earlier and separately than monkeys and apes. In the wild, they can only be found in Madagascar, where they live in groups similar to what you see here. It's not unusual for lemurs in the wild to live together or near other types of lemurs. So what you see in lemur forest is very natural.
So is what you hear. The lemurs don't vocalize often. But when they do, everyone looks around in total surprise, trying to figure out what that sound could have come from.
Those are the animals that were making the noise?
Yeah. Kind of like loud seals, like yapping, kind of like on a beach or something.
Kind of like a hamster? They don't seem to make any noises.
I would have thought of a bigger animal would have made that sound.
At their best, zoos are places where we get to check out animals we might never get a chance to see otherwise. But they're also a place for us to examine our own relationship with wilderness, what ways we impact it, and what influence we can have. So it makes sense then that in a space like this, we're both part of the conversation.
talking to you.
For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Kingsley-Mott.
Thanks, Hannah. That story was originally produced in May 2016, and you can find more audiographs that feature sounds from around the bay at KALW.org. Now let's wrap it up with some local music. This is Donna Francisca from San Francisco. They're playing Sunday night at the Swedish American Hall as part of the Leonard Cohen Festival.
What are you waiting for, my friend? The time is now, because you can. What's gonna make it happen? Yes, that's you. The early mornings and late nights, another hustle every day. You gotta shake it till you break all through. And when sometimes you...
Today's Cross Currents team includes Janae Darden, Julia Linus Goodman, Kristen McCandless, True Quinn, Marissa Ortega Welch, and Victor Tense. Our engineers are James Rowlands, Tariq Foda, and Gabe Graben. Content manager is Shireen Adil. Our managing editor is David Boyer. Deputy news director is Angela Johnston. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. And we're off on Monday for Veterans Day, so catch us next Tuesday. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.
You should be ready, whatever it takes. Picking yourself up like a warrior. Another battle.